Welcome to Golau, where we shed some light on politics, policy and polling in Wales and the world. Welcome back to another Golau Brextacular. Does that work? Can I get away with that? There were no groans this time. That's great. So pleased to introduce a couple of new voices to this episode where we'll be talking about Brexit and the party conferences. Manon Edwards are here.
Hello.
And Hedith Philip.
Hiya.
And Professor Roger Scully, fresh back from Aberystwyth.
Hello.
I wonder if we could kick off with the EU withdrawal bill, which has been top of the agenda now that the party conference season is over. How do we feel the current status of the EU withdrawal bill is, both in Westminster and in Wales?
Well, not good, to put it bluntly. I know it's unusual to introduce a note of bad news into discussions of Brexit, but a lot of the attention in the news media has understandably been on sort of the external face of Brexit, the negotiations between Britain and the EU. But there's a very important sort of internal element to this, including a necessary legislation if Britain is going to leave the European Union, to sort of legally detach Britain from the EU and all of the various parts of our life that are entwined with EU rules and regulations and obligations and so on and so forth. This EU withdrawal bill is, you know, the key centrepiece of legislation. When it was introduced, it was heavily criticised by the First Minister of both Scotland and Wales. It's been subject to scathing criticism by many serious constitutional law scholars and others who think it's, you know, deeply problematic in many respects. But it's also very clearly running into problems in Parliament. I think many people think that certainly in its current form the bill will not get through the House of Lords. It will not also get legislative consent from the Scottish Parliament or the Welsh Assembly. But it seems as if it's not even in its current state able to get through the House of Commons. So, you know, as if things were not difficult enough externally, internally it seems as if, you know, the government, divided within the Cabinet, also cannot command Parliament.
I thought what was quite interesting as well in terms of the amendments, over 300 I think people have put in, with a set of amendments put in by Ken Clark and Chris Leslie, looking at possibly, you know, centering their amendments around the Florence speech, Theresa May, which obviously, you know, they can't just dismiss them outright. They've got to be seen, government has got to be seen to be following what Theresa May promised in that Florence speech. And therefore, you know, it's a sticky one, you know, those sets of amendments are sticky ones, along with all the others as well that they've got to work through.
It's very interesting, very telling that those are also backbench amendments rather than the Labour frontbench putting up its own serious amendments. Most of the Labour's frontbench amendments seem to be fairly modest suggestions to amend the bill, but the really meaty stuff appears to be happening in the backbenches, and maybe that's with the intention of trying to build cross-party support for them. I mean, there certainly seems to be a big enough a cohort of MPs from across the chamber who are willing to support some of those amendments that maybe make more substantial changes to the bill. What do we think about the joint amendments submitted by the FMs of Wales and Scotland, the Scots and Welsh governments?
I mean, others here may have views sort of more on the legal aspect of this. The politics of this, I think, are fascinating. Yeah, I mean, look at the sort of the state of relations between the SNP and the Labour Party in recent years. I mean, in Scotland, certainly, relations have been utterly toxic for a long time. And to see the First Minister of Scotland and Wales, a Labour and SNP First Minister, working so closely together is extraordinary. And to see them doing so essentially in tandem against the UK Prime Minister, I think, you know, this is a big step, particularly for Carmen Jones as First Minister, to be working so closely with the SNP as still, you know, a unionist Labour figure, to be working with, yeah, separatist Scottish First Minister against the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. And I think it's a measure, above all, of just how appallingly managed the internal politics of Brexit have been.
I think, as an aside, what's interesting about that as well is Karen Jones' standing within the Labour Party as possibly one of the highest-ranking moderates who's still allowed a voice because of his position, and therefore, you know, what he says about Brexit possibly is a little bit more open than what some of the other higher-ranking, you know, Remainers in Labour are allowed to say.
Yeah, and I think it's clear that, you know, not all people in the Labour Party, certainly not all Welsh Labour MPs, would be entirely comfortable with him working so closely with the SNP and Nicola Sturgeon on this. But after the general election, where Carwin Jones very much led the Labour campaign here, he is a greatly strengthened figure. And he's accumulated political capital through the general election, and he's spending it now.
As an observer, he seems to be almost at his most comfortable when he's dealing with these issues of state and of constitution. That seems to be his safe territory, and he seems more willing to express himself and maybe put his own stamp on the Welsh Labour Party and Welsh Labour government in this regard.
I think these are issues where he has been talking, some of the things he's saying these days, he's actually been saying for quite a few years. From quite a long time, it seems, as he wasn't really getting anywhere, even within his own party. Also, with the context of Brexit, it's bringing many of these issues to the fore, and he's been very strong. I mean, the Institute of Welsh Affairs held a conference on the 20th anniversary of the 1997 devolution referendum, and I've never, Carwin Jones gave an address there, and all the individual things he was saying, he's pretty much said before, but I've never seen him put them together and say them in such a forceful way, where he very clearly seemed to be shaping up for a major battle with the UK government.
With regards to the bill, I mean, it's so heavily criticised that it's kind of forced their hand. It's so disrespectful with regards to the devolved administrations that it's hard to see them not collaborating in order to stand up against those clauses. So in a sense, it's forced Carwin to discuss those constitutional issues, and it's forced people to listen to him.
When the electoral bill was first published, it reminded me of the Wales bill in terms of the reception that it got. I mean, it was near universal proclamations of how poorly drafted it was. But there seems to be something very different in the way that the Welsh Labour government has responded to this, in that with the Wales bill, 2016 as it was, there was a lot of constructive, let's reset, and the Secretary of State paused the process and reset and came back with a better draft. But there has been no such indication that anybody in DECSU or in the UK government at the moment is really taking that on board, until we had the JMC last week, when Damien Green, they came out with this communique of joint priorities, is that
principles,
right?
Principles. Yeah.
And that seemed to be the starting of a process to try and come towards some kind of agreement. What do we think?
Well, I mean, the communique was, as these things normally are, warm words. I thought it was at least as interesting for what it didn't say. That's what it did. I mean, what it did say was fine, we're looking to work together, but there was very little in terms of the principles on which they'll be working together. And because this is a situation where the UK government is starting from a fundamentally different set of principles from the Scottish and Welsh governments. The UK government's principle is that, powers coming from Brussels come to us, that, we in a sense have ultimate control over where those powers lie. The Scottish and Welsh governments, their belief is that, you take away EU level restrictions and obligations in areas like agriculture, the environment, fisheries and so on, well, anything that remains automatically comes to us, because these are devolved areas, and if we need any UK-wide frameworks, it's for us to voluntarily agree those with you. There's a fundamentally different mindsets, and the communique, warm though it was, showed no real indication of fundamental changes in position from either side.
I think what's interesting as well is possibly, they are the devolved governments, but if you're talking about an alternative voice and an alternative stance on Brexit, that's not coming hard and fast from the Labour Party, from the main UK opposition party, mm-hmm. which, they've got their own issues about it. They didn't even discuss it in their Labour Party conference. So in a way, that allows possibly, the voice of very strong opposition are coming from the devolved governments.
What is it that the devolveds find quite so unlikable about the way the bill is drafted, Edith?
There's a lot that's been mentioned in evidence sessions to the different committees that in Westminster that have been looking at this bill, and many have talked about a lack of trust. That the wording in the bill that prevents the devolved legislatures from legislating in line with EU retained law, which is what EU law will then become once it's anchored into UK law post-Brexit, the fact that that's there in such explicit terms points to a lack of trust from the centre to the devolveds. It's not in their interest to go and legislate vastly outside of what they can do now. Every government has stated very clearly that they want to work on frameworks, but the wording of the bill is such as to disregard that. The UK government is asking for trust in the way that it won't give to the devolveds.
Yes, it's almost like trust is good, but control is better, really, isn't it? That's the way that it seems to be going. One of the things that's quite interesting is we've seen in the last week or so, we've seen both the Farmers Union of Wales and also, I think just today, the CBI, IOD, have all written letters trying to get the UK government to accept a continuation of membership to the single market during transition, or confirmation at least of the transition period and what that will be. And then we're seeing a sort of hardening of stance on one side of the Tory party, which is this no deal side of it. What do we think?
I think there's a definite lack of patience as well. And I think on a practical level, the fact that the CBI, the FSB, IOD, the business sector has come out, and it is terribly complicated, as we all know. It's got to be picked apart, but business doesn't wait, life doesn't wait, the economy doesn't wait. They've got to have some kind of reinsurance. So I think it's a clear warning signal just to get on with it, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I think lots of people are understandably getting very concerned. We have really no more than a year to agree a deal with the EU. There's got to be several months left for ratification through national parliaments, even some regional parliaments, of any deal if it can be reached. The absolute final deadline is the end of March 2019. So if you work back from that, we have no more than a year left. We've wasted a lot of the time that's gone thus far. And there's not a great deal of obvious progress, and we haven't even begun any official negotiations on the future relationship between Britain and the EU. We're still negotiating simply the departure agreement, which is meant to be actually quite a limited agreement, and lots of people are understandably getting extremely concerned for the future for business and so on. And I think we are reaching the bizarre position at Westminster, for instance, where a Jeremy Corbyn-led Labour Party is effectively becoming the voice of business and articulating many of the concerns of business. And who could have ever believed that might be possible?
Seeing how difficult it's been for Theresa May to come, and the government to come to any sort of conclusion on the withdrawal, I mean, the trade is even, and the future agreement is so complicated. There's so much to work out. And if they can't even agree on these key three first points that the EU are presenting them with, how are they going to come to a position on the future agreement? And then how are they going to negotiate those positions? And I think that realisation is slowly coming to bear.
And I think as well, the kind of language that Theresa May used in Florence about, she didn't want to go for any kind of mechanism or any kind of model that's there already with Norway. She wants something uniquely special. Well, that takes a lot of planning. That takes a lot of working together. And the EU's got other 27 countries to also, it's got its own day-to-day work. It isn't completely focused on Brexit, is it?
Yeah, they've got other issues that they're trying to work out.
Something that was very clear in Jean-Claude Juncker's State of the Union address to the European Parliament fairly recently was how much of it was about looking beyond Brexit to the future agenda of the European Union, talking about the 27, the member states that are going to be continuing in membership. And I think, one of the things that's becoming very clear from Brussels and from the rest of the EU is huge impatience, partly just wanting to get on with the EU's future business, but also impatience with the UK. I think a feeling that through much of the period of our membership has not been that clear what Britain has wanted. Mm. Now we voted to leave, and they still don't know what on earth Britain wants, because we have a divided government that did no preparation for this thing. Brexit is the most complicated thing the UK state has tried to do since it fought World War II, and we're trying to do it without having prepared and without having any sort of coherence and unified government line on it. So I'm sure it'll go well.
It's further complicated by the fact that it's not just a process that's happening, it's a political process that's happening, and the government here don't just have to deal with the UK media, but they've got to deal with the whole of the EU media as well. I mean, revelations out in the German press this weekend about Theresa May asking for help, and there's a lot of plotting and subplotting within the countries, countries against countries, people within the EU, as well as the UK press having different stances as well. So, it's an absolute PR press spin minefield for Theresa May's government.
Definitely. And also for the EU and the EU machine, because it's been very good up to this point at maintaining unity, maintaining a clear line, and making sure that the message, the narrative, that they own it. And revelations like this weekend means that they might be losing grip on that, and they won't want to do that. That's why Martin Selmayr, who is Juncker's right-hand man, came out so strongly on Twitter today saying that they weren't the source of this leak. We all know that the EU is quite leaky. For that strength of message to be coming out, it's clear that it didn't come from them, but it's also clear that they will want to maintain a firm grip on the narrative from their side as well.
It is somewhat ironic, isn't it? A lot of people were talking straight after the Brexit referendum that there was an expectation in the UK government that the divisions among the 27 European countries would be their opportunity. That would be an opportunity for the UK government. The UK hasn't even agreed amongst the four constituent nations of the UK a common position. In some cases, it doesn't even recognise that there should be a negotiation there. And on top of that, we had a story last week, I don't know if you picked up on this, that there hadn't been a single cabinet discussion about future trade policy in the UK government. And that seems extraordinary. And as you say, Roger, on an issue that is quite so consequential as Brexit, for a cabinet of a single government to have not agreed on a position seems quite extraordinary, almost seems reckless.
It is extraordinary, but then why would they not have the discussion? Because Theresa May knows that it would bring to the fore what are already pretty obvious, substantial divisions right at the core of the government. I think what you're saying about the expectations in the UK of divisions in the rest of the EU, I mean, of course, not all EU member states are going to be wholly unified on all of this, but so much of the story of Brexit thus far has been the story of hubris, of ridiculous overconfidence by many of the Brexiteers that various problems would vanish, or that the other EU member states would dissolve into disunity and Britain would be able to divide and rule. In fact, the other countries seem to have pulled together to a remarkable extent. And as you say, it's the internal divisions within Britain that are, if anything, all the more noticeable.
Yeah, the certainly seems to be taking a wrecking ball to traditional party lines. It's almost like the end of British party politics, isn't it? I should make a note of that. It'd be a great title for a book.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think one thing which is clearly happening is that the UK's reputation, which I think it just had, to a certain extent it did have in the EU, in the other European capitals, and more generally abroad for high quality diplomacy, is being utterly trashed. Mm-hmm. We are making ourselves into an international laughingstock.
Well, that has given us the injection of positivity I was looking for in the discussion of Brexit. Should we move on to the conference season? And where better, if we're looking for brevity and lightheartedness, where better to start than the Lib Dems? Feels like an awful long time ago, doesn't it? What do we remember of the Lib Dem conference?
Almost nothing.
Not much, obviously. I mean, it was marked in its absence of coverage, to be honest, and, my neck of the woods. Yes, it was ignored by most people and most media.
What is the problem with the Lib Dems right now? Because there was a certain logic after the referendum on EU membership that the Lib Dems thought, we'll double down on being the pro-European party, and the voters ignored them for the most part. They made a few modest gains here and there, but lost their only seat that was left in Wales. And the voters that were support keen for a second referendum or continued membership of the EU went to the Labour Party, which was being rather ambiguous about its commitment to that at the time of the election. What is going wrong for the Lib Dems?
Well, I mean, the Lib Dems, had over a period of time from the 1960s generally kind of gradually built up their support level, but a great deal of that was, I think, predicated on them being a party of opposition, a sort of a safe party of protest for people who were dissatisfied with the other two major parties. When they got into government and started actually taking hard decisions and rotating people, a lot of that whole basis for support was effectively wiped out. And they haven't yet been able to rebuild that. I mean, Tim Farron proved to be a rather ineffectual party leader. We'll have to wait and see whether the leader now, who's fairly advanced in years, is going to be any more effective. But the period of coalition did such substantial and deep-rooted damage to the Lib Dems that it may well be that it takes them a very long time, if ever, for them to recover. In Wales, the Liberal Democrats are a minor party now. They hold no MPs, 1 AM. They got less than 5% of the vote at the general election, which is, you know, their lowest ever. They were wiped out in terms of MPs again, which even, you know, not even in the dark days of the 1950s did that happen to them. You know, they are not a significant political force in Wales at the moment.
I think they've got, in a way, they've got two problems. They've got an identity problem. What exactly do they stand for, apart from Brexit at the moment, and a lack of talent? And I agree with Roger about the fact that I think they were stung by being in government, and they're recovering from that. But if they can't manage to garner support for the thing that they stand for, which is Brexit, and appeal to centrist Remainers at the exact time where nobody else seems to be possibly representing them, well, I can't see there's much hope for them, to be honest.
I can do a nice segue here. So talking about the potential future ex-Lib Dems, I can turn to an actual ex-Lib Dem who is the new leader of UKIP, Henry Bolton. Famous guy, isn't he? We all know lots about him.
Household name.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned his name, just to remind us. Yeah.
Character from Game of Thrones.
It's fascinating to see someone who is mild, relatively mild-mannered, not an exhibitionist, being leader of UKIP. I mean, that in itself seems quite interesting. They've opted for a safe pair of hands on what, albeit, might be the tiller of a sinking ship. I mean, we've got a relaunch, rebrand, new campaigns for UKIP doesn't seem to be making a huge amount of difference.
Well, I mean, UKIP were a party who were really electorally very unsuccessful for the vast majority of their life. You know, they had a relatively brief surge in support from about 2013 onwards, partly, I think, because, you know, the old safe party of protest, the Lib Dems, had largely disappeared, and some politically disaffected people turn towards UKIP. But post the Brexit referendum, and with UKIP's main policy being implemented, but they're being implemented very poorly, it's difficult really to see a particular purpose to UKIP. I mean, I think throughout their lifetime they were internally fairly shambolic. They happened to stumble across one figure in Nigel Farage who was extraordinarily good at public projection of their case. He's stood down now. A lot of their financial backers have withdrawn, having, it seems, achieved their main purpose. I think UKIP are struggling for internal coherence, leadership, and any sort of organisational coherence. And, you know, the polls are currently putting them around, 3-4%. I mean, they were a minor party for the vast majority of their existence, and they seem to be back in that status once more.
Yes, I was just going to say, when they I think first established, they were a very broad church. They had people, far left, far right people. It was a very, very broad church with one particular goal. They've achieved that goal. I think Nigel Farage, as he came into prominence, I think he actually polarised people within the party. And since he's gone, nobody else has managed to get them back together. I can't say much more, really.
No, and they're in the Assembly, so whatever is the fate of the party, we'll be stuck with them, for want of a better word, in Wales until, at least the next Assembly elections.
It is rather interesting to think that once the MEP's tenure finishes, that all of the senior representatives of UKIP will all be in Cardiff Bay. I mean, that's a very interesting record for Wales to have, I think, isn't it?
Yes, albeit, okay, with 7 UKIP AMs were elected last year. One of them, Mark Reckless, has jumped ship back to Conservatives. Nathan Gill is no longer sitting with the UKIP group either. So, they're effectively down to 5. And who knows in what other ways they may fragment in the remaining time period. But at the moment, I have to say, you wouldn't want to put a great deal of money on any of their AMs winning re-election.
Although they might get better odds than John Rhys-Evans' new Affinity Party or Anne-Marie Walters starting a new, even further right party called For Britain. And I think that's what's really interesting about UKIP is that the glue that has held that diverse coalition that you mentioned does seem to finally have come apart, and they are splintering off into their respective very, very minor parties. And that does seem to signify the end of a sort of phase. I mean, we're almost back to the days of the Robert Kilroy Silk UKIP party now, which is truly fascinating.
Veritas, yes.
Veritas, indeed.
I remember it well.
Indeed, absolutely. So onto the Conservatives, which again also feels like an awfully long time ago now. Did anything substantially change in the Conservative Party during the conference season?
I don't think anything very much changed. I mean, it's pretty rare for party conferences to see some major change. Obviously, the thing that everyone will remember is Theresa May's conference speech, which didn't quite go according to plan.
I think it's difficult to actually remember anything from it, because all the coverage, everybody's attention was on that speech, and it all became about leadership.
And actually, the speech itself, I mean, who now can remember anything that she actually said?
All the attention was on...
She said thank you to Philip, I think, at one point, didn't she?
all the attention was on the things that went wrong, the security breach, the guy handing her the P45, the bits of the set falling off, the inability of her to actually speak because of her bad throat. I think actually it was one of those situations where so many things go wrong. I actually elicited a certain amount of sympathy from many people, because certainly, I mean, the set falling apart behind her was hardly her fault. And similarly, many people have had situations where they've had to speak and their throat has started to dry up a bit or something. They could have sympathy with her for that. I think what it did clarify is that she is, as she has been since the general election, a greatly weakened political figure who is basically surviving in her job because there is no clear alternative candidate within the party who could be guaranteed to beat Boris Johnson in a membership ballot. There are sufficiently large number of enemies of Boris that they're very aware about triggering a leadership election which he could win. Were there an alternative candidate who would be likely to beat him, then I think Theresa May would be gone by the end of the day. But there isn't, so for the moment at least, I think she's able to hang on because of the lack of an alternative who isn't Boris Johnson.
I think there's also possibly an element of the fear of possibly the Remainers within the party thinking that Brexit is so important, Brexit is somehow more important than the party, which is quite unusual for Conservatives to think like that. But really, if you're going to have that distracting as well, they can't afford for that to happen in a way, and Theresa May is their best bet as long as they're negotiating.
One relatively minor story that I'd like to pick up on is the Conservative Party conference. Adrian Masters of ITV Wales had a sit-down with Theresa May and asked her very specifically the question, who is the leader of the Welsh Conservatives in Wales? And she clarified that Andrew R.T. Davies is the leader of the Assembly Group, but not the party in Wales. And it does ask the question, there was this quite considerable and visible rift in the general election. Is it the Secretary of State, Alan Cairns? Is it Andrew R.T. Davies? Is it the party chair in Wales who is responsible for the Welsh Conservatives? Do, in fact, the Welsh Conservatives exist as a party, or are they an extension of a broader, centrally managed UK Conservative Party from a Welsh perspective?
That's almost like a philosophical question. Do the Welsh Conservatives exist? I think one of the things, of the many things that was extremely interesting about the general election this year, is how you saw, for instance, in Scotland, the Scottish Conservative Party, who do have a very clear leader in Ruth Davidson, running a campaign which had almost nothing to do with the campaign run by Theresa May and the party in London, focusing almost entirely on independence and opposition to a second independence referendum, fighting in a sense on the SNP's turf, albeit with a fair bit of success. We saw in Wales the Labour Party running a campaign where Jeremy Corbyn was almost invisible, certainly in the official campaign material. Carwyn Jones was front and centre, leader of the campaign. Both of those campaigns were successful. Now, whether they were necessarily successful entirely because of those approaches and that leadership is another question, but that did, I think, raise in the minds of a number of senior Welsh Conservatives after their ultimately rather disappointing election outcome, where they lost three seats and been looking initially at gaining ground. Are we missing a trick here? Do we need to actually have a model of the party and its leadership much more the lines of our Scottish Party or the Welsh Labour Party? Certainly, that approach has seemed to work for the party in Scotland, and it's quite possible that some people will be arguing for that to work in Wales. Having said that, if they were to go for that model, raises an interesting question of who would be the best person to be the Welsh Conservative leader.
When I used to work in the BBC and coordinate election coverage, we would always think it's an assembly election, it would be the Welsh Party leader. If it's in Westminster, it would always be the leader in Westminster of that party. And that there used to be clear lines. I think as time has gone on and as devolution has grown and developed, I think they tend to put up whoever's the best performer. So I think it goes from election to election by now is whoever can actually get the people out to vote for them.
Does this mean that we think that Darren Millar is the best performer for the Conservative Party in Wales?
Well, he was the best performer who was willing to do it on a few hours' notice in the BBC Welsh election debate this year.
It is an interesting question, though. I mean, in terms of trying to find a formula for success, because I think it's probably fair to say that in the era of devolution, the Conservative Party haven't been as successful in the Assembly, at least, as they had the potential to be. You would have thought that the Labour model in Wales and perhaps the more recent Conservative model in Scotland of the party in the periphery making itself popular in the periphery by rebelling a little bit against the centre would be a natural mechanism, a natural kind of dynamic that you can see that there's leverage there for to try and leverage a local vote. But that has never seemed to have been on the radar of the Conservative Party in Wales before.
Well, I think we need to remember that Conservatives opposed devolution in Wales in the 90s, and I think probably even to the present day, the significant chunk of the party membership in Wales would be English in origin, in language, and probably instinctively look to London as the centre of political authority, and only reluctantly, if at all, towards Cardiff Bay. I think thinking on those sort of distinctly Welsh terms is something which doesn't come very naturally to a significant chunk of the Conservative membership in Wales. They might be, I suppose, reluctantly willing to engage with a more sort of Welsh model and more Welsh autonomy, more Welsh leadership, if that's the price of political success. But it's not something I think that would be, not a step that would be taken with initial enthusiasm.
I was just going to say about Andrew Artie Davis that actually we have in him a leader in the Assembly that is very Westminster facing. So whereas you have maybe other individuals who are more assembly focused, you know, his support of Brexit, his perceived success that he backed the right side in that referendum, and his unequivocal support for Theresa May and her approach in the Brexit negotiations makes him more of a Westminster assembly leader, if you like. And so it reduces the chance of them being seen as a Cardiff-centric party because of the direction he's always pointing.
And also, you know, the Conservatives in Wales are in opposition, but they're in government in London, so you can have somebody who's part of that government. In Wales, you know, Labour are in government, so you can have somebody who's part of that, aren't you, really? Yeah. So whoever's most successful in whichever, you know, institution, they're going to go for the best-known names.
Interesting. And moving on into Labour, shall we?
Well, I think, Carmen Jones, as we said earlier, is a significantly strengthened figure after the general election, and he cut a more confident figure possibly than the past. He's given rather greater status than in the past. So much has changed, turned around in UK politics in the last few months, and I think the Labour Party conference was testimony to that. I was at the Labour Party conference in Liverpool last year, where, frankly, it felt like a sort of very large-scale collective nervous breakdown. And this seemed like a party that was heading towards disintegration. Its poll ratings were steadily slipping under Corbyn, and you had, you know, had only a few months previously the attempted sort of shadow cabinet coup against him. You'd had the leadership challenge by Owen Smith. There was a lot of antagonism between the supporters of Corbyn and the opponents, who of course included the substantial majority of members of Parliament. And going to the conference, I mean, it seems frankly shambolic and full of acrimony, and this seemed like a party that was just headed towards electoral disaster, and it carried on seeming like that for several months afterwards. At the Welsh Labour conference this spring in Llandudno, it was really interesting how elected Labour politicians, MPs or AMs, were quite openly willing to be scathingly critical and dismissive of Jeremy Corbyn. Corbyn's main speech to the conference hall was horribly inadequate. And his lack of mastery, apparently, of the set piece conference speech was verging on the embarrassing. I mean, this seemed like a party that was heading towards utter disaster. And the initial polls, both Britain-wide and in Wales, and the start of the general election campaign seemed to confirm this. They were 25 points behind in Britain and 10 points behind even in Wales. Now, how extraordinarily different things look like. Somehow, Jeremy Corbyn found his, I think the vernacular is, found his mojo on the campaign trail. It was actually Theresa May who sort of underwent the meltdown during the general election campaign. You know, Labour had a big increase in its share of the vote from last general election, denied the Conservatives a majority, and suddenly Corbyn is this greatly strengthened figure, and the vast majority of opponents of him are either keeping a low profile or they're sort of publicly recanting, even joining in the "Ooh, Jeremy Corbyn" chants or whatever. I mean, it's an absolutely extraordinary political turnaround. It's very difficult to think of any parallel, and one that until sort of mid-May seemed utterly implausible. It's only going to take the cephalological community quite a long time to figure out exactly why this has happened. But it's thinking about the consequences of it now. You know, Jeremy Corbyn is here to stay for some time, clearly, as Labour Party leader. And if the Conservative Party continue to disintegrate under the pressure of Brexit, of course, there's every possibility of a premature general election. And you know, the thought of Jeremy Corbyn being Prime Minister is no longer at all implausible. I remember 18 months ago making some, you know, obviously ridiculous joke about, imagine the first summit meeting between President Trump and Prime Minister Corbyn, as if either of those things could ever happen. Well, one of them has happened and the other is extremely plausible now.
One of the Mirror editorials following Corbyn's performance at the Labour Party conference called him the accidental leader has become an accomplished one. And I think that's what's caught everybody by surprise. I don't think it takes away, though, from the fact, or shouldn't gloss over the fact that if that were to happen, it does leave the Labour Party still. I think it's not a unified party. It's a severely fragmented party. I mean, what's amazing about politics at the moment is that every single one of the parties has a huge identity crisis. Not one of them is unified. And I think in terms of, you know, the identity of the Labour Party, where does it leave all the moderates? Spoke to somebody who was at this year's party conference who said 2 years ago the Corbynistas made up possibly a third to a half of the party makeup in the conference. Last year it was three quarters, this year it was almost 90%. And if you looked at, you know, who was making speeches, the people that we would class as moderates, they were obvious in their absence at this conference, and also delegates stayed away. So it was no wonder he did get those chants. It was the Corbyn faithful and not many others from within the Labour Party who turned up.
And it seemed extraordinary, as you said, Roger, that in the space of 12 months, the tails of two parties, the two biggest UK parties, flipped completely around. Mm. Looking forward to this time next year. I mean, we've run out of flipping options then, haven't we?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, it does seem often in recent times as if, you know, as some sort of political pundit, you might as well just predict the craziest thing you can think of because it's as likely to come true as anything else.
I seem to remember you saying something about the JFK tapes being reopened. So moving on, you know, a long time after the rest of the party conference season has finished, we have just had the Plaid Cymru conference. Mm-hmm. And it was quite fascinating. We were talking about the position of leaders, as we have done with both empowered leaders, perhaps in Carwyn Jones and in Jeremy Corbyn, diminished leaders, perhaps in terms of Theresa May. Where do we feel things are with Plaid Cymru right now? Because there's been a lot of swirling rumour about Leanne Wood.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting if you look at recent electoral record. Leanne Wood has presided over Plaid, increasing their share of the vote and increasing the number of AMs last year, increasing the number of councillors this year, winning two of the four PCC elections in Wales last year, and also increasing the number of MPs this year to equaling their joint highest ever total. And yet she looks like a deeply embattled figure within a party that is looking very troubled. Now, if we try to understand this, I think we need to understand that, you know, the performances in last year's Assembly and this year's Council elections were actually pretty mediocre in potentially favourable circumstances. And the general election this year, although Plaid, you know, I mean, Plaid essentially got lucky. They just held one of their existing seats. They just captured Ceredigion. 100 voters changing their minds across two constituencies, basically, and they end up back on two seats, which would be their lowest total since 1983. And yeah, certainly the assembly group of Plaid Cymru since last year's election has not been a happy ship, and it must have been extremely difficult for Leanne to try to manage that group. I mean, David Ellis-Thomas obviously had a rather strange relationship with his party for a very long time. He finally decided to jump ship. Various other rumours of internal divisions within the assembly group. Of course, recently Neil McEvoy has been suspended from the group. It can't be at all fun trying to manage that assembly group. And Leanne Wood, who's been leader for quite a few years now, you could well understand if she felt that she'd frankly had enough. It would appear from everything she said at the party conference that she's not going to stand down, that she wants to tough it out and continue to lead Plaid for the next few years. But I think that then raises the questions of, can she help the party effectively articulate a new vision that will help the party reach out? Their vote share fell this year, and there are, I think, longer-term problems with Plaid Cymru's vision. And they've talked for many years about independence for Wales within Europe, where Europe was clearly understood as EU membership. Well, Brexit seems to hold that below the waterline. They've also generally looked to outflank Labour on the left, and outflanking a Jeremy Corbyn-led Labour Party on the left seems to be going for a rather narrow bit of turf. So I think there are problems with Plaid's vision, whether they can articulate an effective and convincing vision that is going to appeal to a large number of people in Wales. And whether the person who's been leader for the last 5 years can help the party change its appeal and broaden its appeal is obviously the big question for Leanne Wood and for her party.
I think the surprising thing with Leanne Wood, as you say, that the number of seats they have is possibly lucky, but their share of the vote went down, and that was after very strong performances. And she has blossomed in terms of media as a leader. In the debate, she always performs well. Recognition factor is not too bad, as opposed to publicly. In terms of none of the Welsh leaders score very highly on that one. But having said all of that, and she's had, she's had two very close elections that she's had to fight as Plaid leader and assembly, and then a general Westminster general one. She still hasn't managed to increase the share of the vote, which I think is a worry. And unlike the Lib Dems, there are leaders in waiting, chomping at the bit, wanting to have their go or lining up to take over. You've got your Adam Prices, you've got obviously Rhina Bjorwerth, you've got people who are very ambitious and who want to crack at it as well. So I think she has to be, quite worried.
I think one of the most difficult things for Plaid Cymru is not that how they present themselves, but how they seem relative to other parties. In Plaid Cymru, as Roger has said a number of times on this podcast, they did incredibly well in the first devolution elections, and actually it was the SNP looking to Plaid Cymru saying, oh wow, they've done a very good job. But since then, the SNP has been so successful, the Plaid Cymru just looks by comparison to be not doing particularly well. But then if you flip that the other way and look the other way, you look what's happened to smaller parties like the Lib Dems in the last few years, and you can say, well, Plaid Cymru is not the Lib Dems either. Plaid Cymru is its own thing. So it certainly hasn't matched anything near like the success of the SNP, but doesn't appear in Wales to have suffered the same fate as the Lib Dems.
No, I mean, Plaid have been resilient, certainly. But I think obviously one of their problems, some of the problems that Plaid have had or relative lack of success can be put down to them and what they've done. They've also been relatively unlucky, certainly unluckier than the SNP, in their political opponents, particularly on centre-left, where Welsh Labour have managed the whole politics of devolution infinitely better than the Scottish Labour Party did. And if you look at the general election this year, I mean, one of the reasons I think Plaid did relatively poorly in terms of vote share was that Labour was so effectively stealing a lot of their ground. I mean, if you go back and just read at some of the Welsh Labour literature, even stuff put out by fairly devo-sceptic figures like Chris Bryant and Owen Smith. If you look at the Welsh Labour party election broadcasts. I mean, some of them, frankly, look like the sort of things you might imagine a party like Plaid Cymru producing. In fact, on occasions, I thought some of the Welsh Labour broadcasts, Plaid Cymru might have been embarrassed to put them out. They were so nationalistic. So, you know, Labour was making a big pitch as being the defender of Wales, and it left Plaid Cymru with rather little sort of distinctive to say.
The initial relationship between Plaid Cymru and the Welsh Government on Brexit was very close. They worked together on the first major paper on Brexit, and that was, there was nothing between them, really, in that first paper. But since then, there's been a significant, or at least there appears to have been, a significant breakdown in that relationship.
I think it's a question of need. I think a unified Welsh position between Plaid and Labour suited both parties at the beginning of the year when the joint paper came out. They didn't really need to work together anymore because Welsh Labour found its voice and found an outlet for its cause with regards to the withdrawal bill and Brexit and success in the election. It meant that, frankly, they didn't need to work together with Plaid anymore, which left Plaid to figure out its own position and work out what it was going to do with regards to the Labour position.
Has anybody got any subjects? I've got a couple of little odds and ends that I'd like to bring up. Has anyone got anything I'd like to say?
Throw them at us.
Well, I'm going to say two of the words that put a smile on the face of all political commentators in Wales. David Melding. Has that worked? Yeah, that's worked. I can verify that that has worked. There's a smile on everyone's face. David Melding put out a really interesting paper recently on Democracy in Hard Times was the title, and he's published the first essay of that. Talking about how a future assembly could look like. Are you familiar with this, guys? Have you read this at all? One of the interesting things was he proposed a second chamber made up of citizens of Wales, selected almost like jury service. I thought it was really interesting. I mean, he's an outlier in the Conservative group in the assembly, someone who is willing to go out there, think big thoughts, and actually publish them as well. It's really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, David has been... I think a member of Margaret Thatcher's cabinet was described as semi-detached. I think David has been semi-detached from much of the Welsh Conservative Party, but I think he's sort of accepted that and uses his position to think interesting things and say interesting things. He published an interesting book not that long ago arguing the case for some sort of federal reconstruction of the United Kingdom, which is within the ranks of the Conservative Party pretty radical thinking. Some of the ideas he's coming up with here are... and interesting. I mean, there have been at least a very minor niche within political science of people arguing the case for some time for what's known in political science jargon as sortition. That's where you have representatives chosen at random from the public. It's rather sort of out of the box thinking, but if it gets people thinking a little bit, maybe considering options, then certainly doesn't do any harm and may indeed do a fair bit of good. I'm not expecting there to be a second chamber of the Welsh Assembly elected, you know, chosen through as part of the national lottery at any time in the next few years, but if it does happen, well, we heard it here first, folks. Yeah,
I think it's welcome that anybody can suggest new ideas. We're still a young devolved nation, and if we don't have the opportunity to actually still think and still shape and develop what kind of political institutions should be we should have, well, you know, then we're in trouble. We're not that entrenched yet. We've only been going for 20 years.
Yes, exactly. And with the changes that come in the Wales, the new Wales Act next year, and the fact that the Assembly is more of a say in how it, in its structure and how it's running, it's important for us to be having these debates and contribute to it. What do we want the Assembly to do? How do we want it to look? And how does it become more representative?
Yeah, and I think it's interesting that it's David Melding who's putting these ideas forward, in the sense that he's one of the relatively few people who's genuinely selected across all parties and indeed none within Welsh politics.
And has no agenda himself, which is quite important.
Yeah, and is putting these ideas forward. But I think sort of the respect with which he's held across the political spectrum in Wales, I mean, is, I think, useful testimony, which a few more politicians possibly could learn, that just conducting yourself with a lack of ego and with, you know, old-fashioned courtesy and decency really does actually have quite a lot to be said for it.
Well, It doesn't seem very fashionable these days. I did see one wag on Twitter pointed out that somebody had said that David Melding's ideas were pretty out there. And he said, well, you know, you have to just look down the M4 and see that a second chamber built on hereditary peerage. Thank you very much, everyone. It's been fantastic to have you on the show. So thank you very much, Manon.
Thank you.
Roger.
Dioch.
And Edith.
Dioch.
Thanks for listening to Golai, a Cardiff University podcast. Subscribe in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from to have the next episode download automatically.